You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Hey, welcome everyone to our panel on patent reform and smartphones. My name is Eric Henkes. I'm a legal policy fellow with the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. I'm pleased to see so many attendees here for a discussion on patent reform and smartphones. So, as you know, just recently, the United States Congress passed the American Invents Act. So this was a culmination of about 6 years of work by many people, probably the most sweeping change to the patent system in 60 years. And at the same time, mobile technology companies were in the midst of acquiring massive patent portfolios through mergers and acquisitions. At the same time, they've been readying themselves for an inevitable and impending marketplace war where patents are really the currency. Patent infringement litigation in the mobile space has increased at a frenetic pace in multiple countries and jurisdictions around the world, and companies are now readily using their patents to remove their competitors' products from the market. One pair of well-known companies is embroiled in more than 30 lawsuits and a minimum of 12 courts in at least 9 countries on 4 continents, and each litigant is trying hard to win the race to the first court ruling that will have a major business impact. So a new battlefield has recalibrated the market for smartphones. And with multiple companies jostling for control of this market, each company needs better patents for supremacy. Without them, their devices are likely to be subject to licensing fees or even legal demands to cease using certain innovations. And this dynamic has led to a mad dash of sorts to obtain large patent portfolios for use as both a saber and a shield. So time is of the essence in these disputes. It's not just whether you prevail with a given claim. It's also a question of when, relative to your arrival, you win favorable, impactive rulings. So therefore, one strategy has been to file lawsuits in jurisdictions that resolve cases quickly in a main proceeding. These are called rocket dockets, and these include the Western District of Wisconsin and the Eastern District of Virginia. Lately, however, the ITC, an agency here in Washington, D.C., has become the epicenter of many of these smartphone disputes, and we're going to explore why as part of this discussion. So how will the public be affected? Will the competitor force your favorite mobile device off the market? Our panel of experts, we're very pleased to be joined by, will discuss this and share their thoughts on what lies ahead in the mobile space and beyond. So I'm pleased to introduce our distinguished panel of experts. Raymond Chen is the Deputy General Counsel for Intellectual Property Law and Solicitor at the USPTO. He defends the Undersecretary of Commerce and the Director of the USPTO and the agency in court-related procedures relating to IP and other issues. He also provides guidance on new regulations and guidelines. We are also very fortunate to be joined by the Honorable Judge Essex. Judge Essex is an administrative law judge with the U.S. ITC, which hears international patent and trademark disputes. The ITC has become an epicenter of many of these disputes. We're also pleased to be joined by Amy Hammer. Amy Hammer is a Assistant General Counsel with Verizon Communications. We're very pleased that she could be here to provide a carrier perspective on these disputes. And we're also joined by Sasha Sagan, who is a lead analyst for PC Mag Mobile. Mr. Sagan has reviewed hundreds of cell phones, PDAs, and other gadgets in nearly 5 years with the PC Mag Digital Network. He is an award-winning columnist for PC Mag and speaks frequently. So thank you all for today for speaking on this important issue. And I'd like to first open the floor for some brief remarks. Mr. Chen, please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Eric, and thank you for inviting me to be here and be on this important panel about smartphone patent wars. I guess the first thing I'd say is there have been patent wars for generations and generations, and now with this relatively recent technology, smartphones, now we're seeing it converging here. And it's a little more complicated for smartphones than other technologies, but this can go all the way back to the steam engine, where there were patent litigation wars about that. And same thing with the initial telephone. And the Wright brothers were particularly vicious with patent litigation 100 years ago. And more recently, there have been so-called patent litigation wars when it came to genetically modified corn or soybeans. There's even been a serious patent war with diapers, where there's been advances in diapers over the past 20, 30 years, and that's been heavily, heavily litigated, and hundreds of millions of dollars have actually been at stake in those litigations. And now, of course, smartphones, well, now there's billions of dollars involved here. And so when you have this multi-billion dollar industry like this, it's no surprise that the main players are trying to stake out their claim to the market and try to assert whatever they've innovated and protect their property rights. Now, there's a complexity here because with smartphones, there's so many different features involved here, and it implicates so many different kinds of technologies that you have a lot of inventions involved in just one little device like this, right? Because there's microelectronics, there's software programming, there's operating systems, there's signal processing, data processing, error detection, mobile communications. There's just so much going on in these little devices that it's not surprising that there's going to be patent wars here, especially when these things are so valuable. So if you're a relative newcomer to the industry and you want to break into the market, it's not surprising that you better have your own patent portfolio with you, because other people are going to have their patent portfolios ready and willing to defend them. We're going to talk about a lot of things going on here, including the America Invents Act, which gives us, the agency, the Patent and Trademark Office, a real meaningful opportunity to reevaluate so many patents that we've issued based on evidence that perhaps we didn't have in the first instance. Every year, the Patent Office receives 500,000 patent applications every year. Right, so that's like 10,000 applications a week. We're almost like a second post office. It just keeps coming in. And we have 6,000 patent examiners. And it's a pretty complex process to examine one of these patents. But we do issue a number of patents, quite a few patents every year. Maybe it's on the order of 200,000 patents. And, of course, this cuts across all technologies. But the point is that there needs to be some opportunity for a quality check on the patents we issue. The America Invents Act dramatically helps the agency and also the public to bring patents back to us to reevaluate and allow us to use our administrative expertise to evaluate those patents. That includes smartphone patents, and I would expect that people in this industry, given that it's so valuable and it's so commercially important, that we will be seeing our share of of reevaluations of smartphone patents based on evidence that competitors want to bring to us.
Thank you very much, Judge Essex.
Good afternoon. I'd like to first thank you for being here, and I'd like to thank the Stay the Net folks for having me as well. I'm with the ITC. I just want to always take a quick survey. How many of you know what the ITC is and who we are and what we do? This is a very good knowledgeable audience. I usually don't get that many, so I'll skip some of the basics of the way the ITC is organized and how it works. I think we're really getting a bulk of these cases for two primary reasons. The first one being the speed with which we operate. It is our goal to try to get cases done within an 18-month period, and by done I mean ready and appealed up to the federal circuit. That includes what the judges do and the commissioners. I was talking to some people that know a lot more of this area than myself. That's pretty easy for me to do from a state of profound ignorance. But they said that the average cell phone, at least a while back, and smartphone being one iteration, that those designs are good for about 18 months and everybody replaces them. If you saw what I carry in my pocket, you would think I'm a dinosaur. Ray's seen it. He will affirm it. But with the technology that's changing that fast, speed is far more important. If you have a district court that will defend your patent in 4 years, although monetary damages are available, if you're a small company, for example, and you go out of business, that may not be very comforting. But we try to get done 18 months, and so I think that's the first reason. With the turnover of not just the technology, but the style, functionality in that, that a form that's very, very quick is highly desirable. The other thing, and I know this, I've talked to partners in some of the larger firms and so on, and the fact that we are a judge-alone forum that emphasizes patents and no other kinds of cases is very attractive to a number of companies that are involved with this. Not all countries, with the exception of Great Britain and the United States, have any tradition of jury, and I have a friend of mine who in the early days worked with a lot of Asian Rim countries, and when he was trying to explain what a jury is to presidents and CEOs of major corporations. He said it was a horrible thing because they say, well, just you pick 12 engineers. They know the technology. They say, well, no, they can't know anything about technology. Say, oh, so they're experts on the case. They say, no, they can't know anything about that. I say, well, what can they know about? And when he explained, their eyes were big in that. And consistent with their political cultures and their legal cultures, the idea of a judge who's allegedly learned, who only does a certain area, is very comforting. It's something they understand. And because our case has appealed to the Federal Circuit directly, that had a great deal of appeal for a number of the companies who were involved with this. So we have become major players. I think each judge at the ITC, there are six of us currently, and we all have at least two and maybe more smartphone patent disputes. Now, some of these are partners. If you sue Apple, Apple is going to sue you. And if you sue Motorola, they are going to sue you and so forth. So a lot of these are kind of mirror suits, which will be interesting if we judges start to go off on separate paths in that we could have some very interesting orders. Ray, who always has my back, has also reminded me that one other thing that's why the ITC is popular is our ability to do exclusion orders, and that is since almost all these products have at least some components made abroad, we can stop the importation, theoretically, if we find that there is a violation and we find that appropriate, and that, again, is very appealing. The one thing we don't do is money damages, but in this kind of war, if you can keep your opponent from importing something for the next year and that, you pretty much won, and you pretty much won't have an opponent that year. Now, they don't always take advantage of that. Normally, we will get people that will take licenses after they lose, and they usually do so, I'm told, on very robust terms. If it's import or die and you have to pay what they're asking, that's a real leverage. That's a very much of an advantage. So I think those are the reasons right now that the ITC has become an important player in these cases. And I think for the foreseeable future, we will. We have done a lot of electronics cases, so I think the players are comfortable with us. The parties, if you see the handouts, if you haven't seen the handouts, they're terrific with the red lines everywhere. It used to look like my grade card. But those players are companies that have been in front of us time and time again, so they know where we're at. They're kind of comfortable. And I think that in the foreseeable future, we will continue to be a player.
Thank you, Judge Essex. Ms. Hammer.
So thanks very much for having me here today, and this is a great topic and incredibly timely when you look at the last 3 months' worth of decisions, including from our colleague here on the panel, that affects smartphones. So I want to offer the carrier perspective, and first and foremost, I want to say that we live in a really exciting time, and part of that excitement is because of the growth of smartphones and the mobile broadband networks generally. So the topic of this panel is the smartphone wars and warfare, and I'm going to borrow that imagery for a minute to talk about it. And the first thing I want to talk about is the weaponry. As the judge just mentioned, exclusion orders and injunctions are increasingly becoming the weapons of choice for patent holders who seek to litigate, and that has created a very high-stakes game. There's a lot at stake here. Just as the judge was asking how many of you are familiar with the ITC, I want to ask how many of you have a smartphone? Okay, so this is really almost a rhetorical question. I can see it on your faces. Why are you asking me this obvious question? The point is that consumers really love their smartphone. I, as Sasha pointed out, I still have my BlackBerry Curve. I love it. I also have a Droid, but, you know. So it is really becoming important, and it's really something that consumers love. As carriers, we build the networks that facilitate this. So we have a complementary interest. The more smartphones that are purchased, the more we build and invest in our network. So the stakes are extremely high because it could affect smartphones, pull them off the market, and it could also affect our ability to continue developing the network that supports the smartphones. So if those are the weapons, what are the arsenals? And if you haven't seen a handout, I brought this handy chart. And for your purposes, if you don't have it in front of you, just take a look at the red lines. And it's meant to be a graphic that gives you an idea of what the smartphone wars look like when you put it on paper. The patent, the small box in the middle of the patent arsenal chart shows you the number of patents that potentially have relevance to certain phones. So if the wireless standard is 2G, you're talking about 100,000 potentially relevant patents. If you look at 4G, over 500,000. That's a pretty staggering number. It's the fact of the number itself, plus the fact that the ownership is fractured, it's diverse, and they're constantly being traded, right? That has promoted what some think of as gridlock. Economists call it a tragedy of the anti-commons, but it's where you don't necessarily have a valued good able to get to market. You have gridlock and you have waste. So given the weapons, given the arsenals, what are the prospects for peace? I will tell you that we view them as dim. If you look at the second handout, which is on the back page, it's the same graphic, but this time it's denoting the different patent suits that are out there. And you can see in the top right-hand corner the the Kodak cases that were filed last week. So this is classic game theory, right? There you have multiple players. They are rational decision makers. They're motivated by wholly different interests. And it's very difficult to find a common currency that will lead to a resolution. There isn't really a truce-based possibility that's based on mutually assured destruction. So it doesn't seem to be working itself out. I mean, this really is a hot war, and it's a virtually unlimited arsenal. Now, there might be misfires as litigants go. They may not get the decision that they want. There may be design workarounds that are put in place. But the point is that with this volume of cases, with this volume in terms of weaponry, there is going to be an impact. And the new cases that come in continuously. So what would we say that the solution is? From Verizon's point of view, it's a continued and renewed emphasis on the public interest. I think this is a sophisticated audience, and as you know, both the courts and the ITC have a requirement that they consider the public interest, and the wording's a little bit different. But that goes into the decision-making by law, either by the eBay case for purposes of injunction at the district court, or for the ITC in their statute. By any definition, I think it's fair to say that broadband wireless innovation and competitiveness is a major public interest. It's obviously a top national priority for the country. Just take a look at the Obama administration with their National Wireless Initiative, the president's presidential memorandum, the FCC's National Broadband Plan. It is a top priority for this country. We therefore believe that we should have a first do no harm principle when it comes to the wireless framework. Smartphones are a cherished good, as we were just talking about, and we don't want to see them taken off the market. The individual impact is one thing. I'm not talking about any specific case, but it certainly is an even greater risk when you look at the cumulative impact. So, again, it's a pleasure to be here. It couldn't be a more timely subject.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sagan.
My name is Sasha Segan. I'm the lead analyst for mobile at PC Mag. I've been covering the mobile phone space exclusively for about 8 years. And I guess I'm here to speak more from the consumer and market perspective. I'm not a lawyer and don't have strong, clear opinions on nuances of law. But I have reviewed a lot of smartphones, and I am constantly talking to consumers about what they want. And just as Amy said, what consumers want is more innovation, more choices, more options, and a constant stream of new great phones and smartphones coming to market to make their lives more interesting, more useful, more convenient, more fun. Now, I was thinking about this topic of the smartphone patent wars and thinking about the past 8 to 10 years in wireless. And for quite a lot of that, up until probably about, I'd say even 2009, there was a general thrumming of lawsuits under the surface of the wireless industry. But to borrow a metaphor from Amy, they did have a common currency, and that currency was the U.S. dollar. These lawsuits, as Ray and Judge Essex have said, it takes a lot of different inventions to make a smartphone. And those inventions come from a lot of different people. Everybody wants a piece of that dollar. And eventually, usually, that dollar got worked out. Sometimes it would get worked out in a great cloud of smoke, like with RIM and NTP. But eventually, it would get worked out. So what changed? In my mind, what changed is actually in Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs. And that is Steve Jobs specifically decided to, quote, go nuclear on Android. Android, as you know, is the leading smartphone operating system in the country. And a lot of different companies have pieces of Android. Apple, which has, for all intents and purposes, an unlimited amount of cash right now, and has really no need to get cash from anyone else, decided to take a strategy of, instead of demanding licenses, instead of demanding money, using its patent arsenal to force its competitors' products off the market when possible. And when not possible, simply to try to delay its competitors' products and slow down their speed of innovation. So I feel like there's been a real change, a real qualitative change in the goals of this patent litigation in smartphones over the past couple of years. And my big question and my big worry is that it's going to continue and it's going to become more vicious in terms of companies attempting to ban and bar each other's products through the ITC, which is very detrimental to consumers, versus just companies having the usual debate over who gets how many hundreds of millions of dollars over what, which is not actually that detrimental to consumers.
Thank you very much. Now, just to follow up on your recent point, do you believe that the smartphone war is a temporary phenomenon? Is there a market-based solution? Are they going to run out of cash? Are they going to run out of initiative to have lawsuits? Do you think this will end, or is this just a battle of attrition over time of depleting resources?
Well, I think the company that's really setting the tone in terms of the smartphone litigation right now and is initiating a lot of the battles is Apple. If you look at this chart, Apple's at the center of a lot of these diagonal lines. And if you read the biography and look at a lot of his statements, Steve Jobs personally took an interest in the stance Apple is taking on patent litigation. Mm-hmm. Now that Apple has a new management team, is the company's attitude going to change? Are they going to be more oriented towards, for instance, looking for licenses for their patents rather than barring competitors' products? Mm-hmm. I don't know, but I think that change in attitude is the only thing that could ratchet this down.
Okay. Now, to follow up on that, Mr. Chen, what actions or policy changes has the Patent Office taken or plans to take, you know, in light of the American Invents Act? You know, is this going to be a substantial tool that enables these processes to go more smoothly? How do you see this from the patent side?
Sure. The Patent Office, we haven't really been looking at this particular industry, this particular, I guess, current spasm of litigation and trying to pivot in light of that. But we do see across the board a need to do what we can to not only improve the speed of our processing of applications, but also improve the quality of the products that we issue, whether they are the issued patents or the issued trademarks. And so that takes me back to our now new opportunity under the American Invents Act to revisit the patents we issue and reassess their and test the quality of them when another party, like a competitor perhaps, would request the PTO to take a second look at a patent. And now we're going to be able to do that in a way that we were never able to do before. Before, for the past 30 years, we've had an administrative mechanism called reexamination, where we could reexamine patents. The problem with that was, without going into the gory details, it takes a long time for a reexamination to be completed within the agency, and there's a lot of statutory reasons why that is so. The new proceedings given to us by the AIA allow us to do this type of review of a patent within 1 year. So now we're going to be able to go a lot faster and be able to get to a decision point much more quickly, which will benefit the public, will benefit competitors in order to make rational business decisions on whether or not this particular patent is a sound patent.
Do
So that's something we're going to be able to do, whether it's a smartphone, whether it's a biotechnology patent, or a very important pharmaceutical patent, whatever the case may be.
Do you think there's a role of, or a, an object of patent quality, or an aspect of patent quality in a lot of these disputes?
Oh, absolutely, because you know, one of the problems with this category of applications is, unlike, say, the pharmaceutical industry, there's a very standardized vocabulary you see in any patent relating to chemistry or biotechnology. When you get into the computer arts, now people start kind of inventing their own terminology when they start describing their invention and then claiming their invention. At the end of every single patent that we issue, there's a section called the claim section, which is sort of the place where, in words, you describe the legal definition of what is the four corners and scope of your patent right that the United States government, the USPTO, is granting you as the owner of that, that you can control and exclude others from practicing. But the patent claims section sometimes, let's just say to the layman, can be difficult to read. And that's part of the exercise here inside the agency. One is the patent valid? The second question is, are these patents clear enough so that people, when reading these patents, can understand them and make good decisions based on that? And then the third issue, really, is what's the proper value of any patent that we grant? And that's another issue that's been where you see the courts going through a form of judicial reform. We've been hearing about patent reform in Congress, you know, right across the street for the past 7 years. Well, there's been another patent reform that's been going on the past 7 years over in the judiciary. And there's been a lot of different issues within the world of patent law that are getting recalibrated, hopefully to better balance the overall patent system. And one of those is the damages issue, whereas for too long, really, there was not enough of a rigorous analysis needed for a patent owner to proclaim that he or she's patent value is millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. But now the Federal Circuit, which is the main patent court in this country, has been cracking down on that and really requiring patent owners to prove a very close nexus between the value of the patent and whatever proposed damage award they have. So there's always going to be inventions that merit patent protection. And then the next question is, are those patents written clearly enough? And then to me, the third question is, are we putting a proper dollar value on those patents when they're being litigated in the courts or when parties are trying to license those patents?
Thank you. Judge, I want to follow up on that. Do smartphone and tablet patents present unique challenges for the ITC, you know, for, of course, the hearing process?
If they keep filing, they're going to pose a scheduling challenge. But our practice has been more in electronics than chemistry or any of the other areas. For some reason, we don't get the same challenges from the medical field. And they're very similar. If you can do most electronic patents, the issues are quite similar. The volume of them is posing a challenge, and then the other challenge that I think they pose is, we mentioned, I saw somewhere printed, I don't know where, that your average iPhone will have somewhere of 2,000 upwards patents per phone, just in everything in that device. And when Ray was talking about them earlier, he left out the ones that are save energy and circuits that will shut down and then redetermine what they have. They're just incredibly complex. And what that does for us in terms of challenge is, you know, if somebody were to come in and want to assert 1,000 patents, we just couldn't handle it, to be frank. We're having trouble handling when they assert 7 or 8 patents in a case and 5 or 6 claims per. That is a challenge. So far, we have not really had any that posed so many claims and so many patents that they actually ran the clock out on us. But as the caseload continues, as the number of patents involved continues, it can be very, very difficult. The other thing that I have noticed, and I just want, for those who are interested, we don't all work in a vacuum here, because I do talk with the PTO about things I'm seeing, and, you know, patents 10 years later when they come and bring them to us, and the language and so forth. So we are communicating And that's when I think Judge Rader at the Fed Circuit has led the way in, and all of us communicating in different ways in the area to try to make sure we're all aware of problems, because in talking with folks, sometimes I'll learn difficulties and problems that happen someplace else that I wasn't aware of. So I think there is some useful reform going on, or at least some useful communication that's going to be helpful down the road. But another problem we see, and in one of my earlier cases, you know, when you're talking about complete software systems, and those of you in the room probably know far more about than I, they can assert a patent that has to do with one very small feature of a phone. And the one potential difficulty of the ITC is we have either general exclusion order or limited exclusion order, but we have exclusion orders as our remedy. And, you know, if we find that there is a violation of a patent, it would be very difficult to say, but it's not important enough for us to exclusion order. You just wasted all of your money, time, and so forth. And that is a problem. And some of the asserted patents were on something that, in terms of the whole function of an iPhone, really, I shouldn't say iPhone, this was a different company actually, but it just had to do with an incredibly tiny feature that most people probably don't use in the life of their phone, although I just use mine to make phone calls, so I'm probably a bad example to know what you do with these special phones, but that is another problem. And, you know, I think some companies have taken a strategy, which from a business standpoint I suppose is legitimate, but as you all know, some of these players are fairly large companies. If they have a portfolio of 20,000 patents and you're relatively small starting out, and they say come and assert three and saying, by the way, we've got 19 more thousand behind you. Do you want to take a license with us? Or, you know, if you win these three, you know, they can come with three more and three more. And it's, in terms of the analogy that's been used earlier, the war, this is a war of attrition. And there are some companies that are just incredibly well equipped to fight a war of attrition. And it's been touched on that Apple has, I can't remember what was in the book, but $40 billion to spend doing this if they should choose. Microsoft has tremendous financial reserves as well. Some of these other companies are sitting there that they can outlast almost anybody if it just comes down to that. So there are a lot of factors that are in play. The number of patents that involve cell phones make this a field that, you know, whether or not the war will go over, ordinarily we've seen in other areas like the liquid crystals play TVs and that. There are several core technologies, and once they had a few decisions on those, the field kind of worked itself out. But with this many patents and this many company owning patents and this many companies with great buckets of cash behind them, I don't have a clue when this is over. I can tell you right now we're scheduling cases into 2013, so I have a good chance of being here on this subject till they're done. But, you know, how long, if there are some of these companies look to be smaller players, how long they'll be able to survive, I have no clue. And how long companies are going to be willing to spend. You know, if you had $40 billion, spending all of it may not seem like a good idea if you're a shareholder. I don't know. So we're just going to see. I can't give a real good answer to that issue, but I can tell you that with the number of patents out there and the amount of cash behind them, there's no reason to assume that this has to stop. It certainly is not in the cards that they will, you know, get bored or run out of money before any of us get old and gray, although some of us have a real advance on the old and gray. So,
Eric, can I just ask the judge a quick follow-up question?
Course,
it touches on something that Amy brought up before, which is the fact that right now the only remedy you can get when you have an infringement finding at the ITC is an exclusion order. You can't ever get damages. You can't ever get money for an infringement. You can only knock someone out of the market, the United States market. I was wondering, currently under your statute, is there any flexibility to do anything in light of some kind of public interest factor? I ask because there was a recent commission decision from the ITC that that found infringement, but apparently delayed the order of exclusion.
Well, you're probably talking about the broadband case, and that morphed into Kyocera. We do have to consider the public interest. Now, that has always kind of been in the statute for the last 20 years. It's kind of laid there, and nobody really knew what it meant. Nobody poked it too much. There were a couple cases, but the commission has revived the doctrine, and normally as a judge taking the evidence at a hearing, we weren't supposed to be looking at public interest unless specifically ordered by the commission. And for the first 3 years, I never worried about it because they never did. And the last couple of years, they have ordered us to look at public interest. Case you're thinking of, there was a chip, Qualcomm was the producer?
It was Qualcomm Broadcom, yeah.
The Qualcomm Broadcom case. Essentially, if we excluded this chip, firefighters, policemen, no emergency workers could talk to each other. And that was where we kind of revived and we thought about this public interest, and they worked it out eventually, but that revived the commission's interest in public, the public interest. And they have since asked us to consider that. Again, it's going to be a little bit difficult because if the public interest can trump infringement and exclusion order, there's no reason to come to us whatsoever unless, as I said, you're just dumping money. So it is possible. It is there in the right case, in the Qualcomm, Broadcom case. I remember they brought firefighters and they brought policemen and, you know, they had a number of stories about what would happen if they could not communicate. And it was very persuasive. It was a very important consideration in that case. But normally the public interest between an Android and an Apple is not so great that it's going to impact that I've ever seen. But in the right case, it certainly can prevail. It has several times. And you could see it, although, again, in a case where you have a number of competitors and systems, so if I don't let her have Apple phones tomorrow, she's got the Motorola Razr and a bunch of them to start phones. Out Droid. And she's willing to show them to you after this. I've seen her bag. They're all in there. But so that's probably the public interest is going to be difficult in this scenario because if you can't get that one, you can get this one or that one or this one down here. So I don't see that will be a big player, but it's certainly potentially a player. And for those who follow the ITC, and I don't know why you wouldn't, the commission is kind of reviving it. And I think it will be seen in more cases. We are taking evidence on it more than we used to, and it's back in play.
So if I could follow up
of
on
course,
that, this is of critical importance to us, this question about the public interest and the Broadcom-Qualcomm dispute that you mentioned, and then I think more recently we saw a sort of creatively tailored response in a case that delayed implementation of a limited exclusion order for 4 months. Again, going back to the time period for the speed at which this technology travels. To our view, it is absolutely critical that public interests come into play because it may be that there is that the argument is made, oh, well, there's another substitute out there. Verizon offers this phone, but they also offer that phone. To us, that is that's part of the discussion, but it misses the overall point about the not only individual aspect of any one case. And by the way, we don't take sides in these cases. This is a general point. It is not specific to any one case. But it's also the cumulative impact and the overall ability for consumers to feel that they can purchase these phones, they're going to stay on the market, they can get serviced, and then when they're ready, they can move to the next one, their acceptance of smartphones, and our ability to spend building out the network. Verizon's certainly not the only one. I think we have made absolutely massive billions and billions of dollars worth of investment in the network. Certainly the other carriers are doing the same thing. And if we want to continue to do that, there can't be this threat over this cherished good that's being held up. And to go back to what Sasha was talking about earlier, too, this is not one. We don't see this as being worked out by the market. You may hear an argument that, oh, it'll play out, you know, sure, there'll be a lot of fighting, but at the end of the day, it'll play out. We don't think so. We see the sheer number of patents in the arsenal and the very disparate interests and motivations of the players here, meaning, as the judge said, that it may end up last man standing, and that is not in the public interest. So it has to be a bigger factor, whether talking about the ITC or the courts generally, and it's been heartening to see this revival of interest in the public interest factor.
Now, if I can just follow up on that for a bit, you know, what impacts will these litigations have on innovation? I'm going to put this question to you and then to Mr. Segan as well. Do you see the trend of rising litigation affecting innovation? You know, recently, there have been cases that come out of the ITC where a company has to remove a feature from a smartphone. For example, HTC has to remove a touch feature from its smartphones. The timing is not really what's important. It's important is the thing is they have to do it. What do you see is from a carrier perspective with respect to offering customers choice and consistency in devices if suddenly a feature has to be pulled from a phone?
So that was a softball from our perspective. Thank you for that. It's bad. It's a bad thing. It's bad for innovation. It's bad for consumer choice. It's bad for the overall goal of making this a wireless nation in terms of having that quality available to consumers. So whether it's a particular carrier that's moving features around, the point is if a feature has become less available and it was a feature that was useful, beneficial, enjoyable, that's bad for consumer choice and it's bad generally for our broadband goals, mobile broadband goals.
And see, you've been reviewing phones for a long time. How have you seen the trend in innovation over a period of time? Has it changed now with these litigations ongoing?
Well, I think the problem regarding innovation with these litigations isn't necessarily about the removal of the small individual features, because this also isn't the first time in technology we've seen features having to be removed because of litigation. Hello, Internet Explorer. But the damage that it does to innovation is about the amount of energy, time, and money that gets bled out fighting these things, as opposed to that money, energy, staff, and time being spent on R&D and creating new innovations. If your technology company basically has to become a giant defensive team of lawyers, as some could argue happened to parts of Microsoft in the late 90s and early 2000s, defensive and offensive. If your technology company has to become a giant team of lawyers, as opposed to focusing its heart and soul and interest in the engineering, then you're losing innovations that never happened, that we never saw. The entire pace of innovation slows down because so much of these companies' energy is being spent fighting each other as opposed to in producing new features. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm really worried about.
Pardon me. I want to throw something in there also that you may not see as much as I do from where I'm at. But one of the other things that happens on exactly what Sasha is talking about is you will see fields and areas that will be metaphorically fenced off. In other words, Microsoft does a number of things in a particular way, in a particular fashion, and then their software is a certain thing. So if somebody wants to avoid that, they will only do their research in another area. So we lose not just the big, you know, breakthrough kinds of stuff, but many incremental improvements, I think, could go on. Now, I'm not an engineer, but I do sit closely to one.
One thing about the brilliance of the smartphone market over the past 5 years and about its speed is that it has been intensely incremental and iterative across many competitors. We've basically had competitors at an extremely high rate of speed building on each other's innovations. To some extent, it reminds me of that game you play with, the game that little kids play with their hands in the car where you go like this, and then in just a couple of seconds, you're very high up in the air. Well, if areas become fenced off, and if the legal walls become so high that, for instance, only this company is allowed to discuss multi-touch in this way, and only this company is allowed to discuss this implementation of 4G LTE power management, you have everybody else, once again, spending their time reinventing the wheel rather than inventing the next thing. To compete, they have to find different ways of doing the same thing rather than advancing the state of the art. And that's painful for innovation as well.
I don't know. I just slightly disagree with that in the sense that if you're unable to use some kind of innovation because someone came up with it first and patented it, and you have to design around that, that, if anything, would encourage additional innovation in order to try to figure out how to build a better mousetrap. And that's kind of one of the underlying theories of the patent system, is that not only do you reward that first inventor for that first innovation, but then by disclosing that to the public, then other people can see that and see if they can find ways to design around that and possibly improve it or go in a different direction and learn from that first inventor. So I think you're right, though, that the pace of innovation in this area is going warp speed. I mean, we certainly feel it because the patent applications aren't slowing down in this area. If anything, they're speeding up. So, you know, it's hard to know how bad of a situation will it ever get to the point where nobody's innovating anymore because they can't. So I think another point to make is that and there's another important element of the America Invents Act, which is that it now protects independent invention in a way that's never been protected in the 19th century. There was this notion of prior user rights. But in the America Invents Act now, if you've come up with an innovation and you've incorporated it into your products and you were commercializing that innovation before someone else got their patent, before someone filed a patent application on that patent, now under the law, under the statute, you'll be protected from any assertion of a patent infringement claim by that subsequent inventor and patent owner. So there's now kind of a little trade-off going on there that's pretty important, I think, in crowded areas like this where people are coming up with new ideas and incorporating them rapidly, and then someone's getting to the patent office first, patenting it, and will the other person be blocked? Well, not necessarily, because there's this now what I call an independent invention defense.
Yeah, Judge, I want to put this question to you first. There have been a lot of intellectual property transactions. You've had transactions between defunct entities where people go in like vultures and they take what's left of the company, and it's the patents. You know, we're seeing that perhaps with Kodak now.
Venture capital.
Do you think that this continued trend of consolidation, of patent consolidation, what do you think about this in terms of the market or the role of the ITC in hearing cases? Is there an element of patent consolidation that's relevant from your vantage point?
Well, it's relevant from our vantage point because if you look down on the chart here, I have had several cases involving Motorola, as have some of my colleagues, and they were just bought by Google. And Google, now I don't know why they bought them, but they said they bought them for their patent portfolio. What was it, 17,000 patents, of which 8 were good? This is not me. This is what the article said, that they were like this core set of patents, and the other 16,000, I guess, were just darts that kind of missed the board.
They must be really good.
Yeah, they ate. But it was fascinating to read about it, particularly if you're not in this area, that they said that there was maybe that few was what was really they were buying. But you'll see on this chart, various parties, a lot of business strategy. Now, let's go back to what Sasha was saying, because I don't think you can overemphasize that when companies begin to plot their business strategies based on legal considerations rather than what would be best for the marketplace or what would be best for their profitability other than legal considerations, the potential for mischief is there. Let's leave it at that. But Google bought Motorola allegedly solely, and a large part of it had to do with what was ITC, to get those patents so they could, you know, shoot back at the companies that were shooting, Apple mainly. I think they were in litigation with some others there, too. And you see the same thing with several of these companies. I can't remember precisely which ones have gone out and bought others and so forth, but I know there are at least 3 or 4 there on that chart. And, you know, overall, if I were a business person as opposed to a judge, and I see job security just, you know, it's like spring planting there. It's blossoming all over this chart for me, but for the companies in that, they're making business decisions. They're spending billions of dollars, as Dr. Evil might say, and so forth, to protect themselves legally, defensively, or to fashion a sword that they can attack others legally. I'll defer to you that follow the business market, but that seems that is a wasteful business strategy, if I...
Well, it's a wasteful business strategy unless it's the only way to defend yourself from going out, from being attacked until you go out of business. I mean, just to go back to Amy's war metaphor, we have an arms race going on, where the various parties involved are trying to amass as many patents as they can to both attack and defend. And I don't see this consolidation slowing down until the tenor of the market changes, until the mood changes. I don't necessarily see the mood changing anytime soon. But even as you go through and you look at companies which are not doing so well in the marketplace, a lot of the commentary in the business press swirls around, well, maybe such and such company will descend upon them for their patents. And Amy was reminding me just now, HTC and S3, we have Google and Motorola, and we've had some of the vultures talking potentially about RIM. If they fail, well, who's going to get those patents? So the patents are definitely considered a key part of the business asset right now and something that people are really trying to consolidate.
Well, and just to touch on that and go a bit further, I don't know personally from the IDC perspective, but oftentimes, you know, if you have 100,000 of something, it's hard for you to know exactly how one might be helpful. You got this huge room of stuff. It's like my daughter with her stuffed animals. She doesn't know what she's got, but they're all important to her, but she doesn't know. And a company that's smaller but knows their portfolio might better be able to see how those would work and so on. So I think, as a general rule, if you get this kind of accumulation, you might find that there will actually be less exploitation of good patents in that, because the people that really know them aren't there anymore. I'm sure that Google doesn't know as much about Motorola's patent portfolio as the people used to management did. So I think there are risks here. I don't have a solution. I'm just one of those guys who points out that the ship will go over the cliff. But there are risks here, and I think there are risks to innovation.
I do wonder if the best possible situation here is a Mexican standoff, where everyone involved holds something so critical to everyone else's business that they have to deal with each other civilly. I don't know if we're in that position now. But
that's the mutually assured destruction.
Yeah, mutually assured destruction may be the only possible end to this war.
I think that's what Google basically did with Motorola. Google, relatively speaking, was a late player to the smartphone industry. And they didn't really have, they didn't spend a decade investing, I don't know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in R&D to develop a patent portfolio of a whole sorted array of innovations. But they wanted to get into this industry, so they did. And then, not surprisingly, because it's such a lucrative market, you saw all of these other competitors want to try to figure out a way to exclude Google from it. So Google needed to buy a portfolio that it didn't have like the other competitors did.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to something that Ray was saying a little bit earlier, and Sasha, too, that the patents and the aggrandizement of patents stifle or perhaps indirectly promote more innovation. And you mentioned early on, I think, the aircraft and steam engine and all of that, these thickets that we're gotten into. I think, would you say that it will depend on how quickly innovation can move, especially if you're in a field where things move so, so fast, right? And also on and the subject matter. And it's just interesting to think, I believe with the aircraft, the government actually stepped in.
The government stepped in because of World War I and because our planes really were bad compared to the French planes. And, you know, if the French are beating you in manufacturing, you need to do something. So, but yeah, the government did intervene in that market.
There's a convergence here of so many different technologies, which makes it different than diapers, phones, like the original phones, airplanes, all of that. And but at the same, so that's the challenge here with this current situation. I think, you know, in the end, there's always going to be some level of litigation in this world. Mm-hmm. And the question is it always going to be at this white-hot level? And, you know, from a kind of a long view perspective, the way I see it is, you know, it's natural for there to be an explosion of patent litigation now with a relatively young technology compared to a more mature technology.
I want to thank all of our panelists and open the floor to Q&As. Please step forward to the microphone.
I wanted to back up a little bit. I'm wondering if we're having a bit of a hindsight problem here. Amy, in 2007, Verizon successfully sued Vonage on three patents that were really invaluable that you had spent billions of dollars creating on some key technology that you'd done. And I mention that because I think it goes to the whole case. If we remember famously, John Dvorak and Motorola's CEO and I think Microsoft's CEO came out prior to Apple's announcement of the iPhone saying they'll fail. Apple's stock took a 41% drop prior to the iPhone's launch because everybody said Apple doesn't have a clue about what they're doing in phones. And yet today now we talk about ubiquitous smartphones within the context of Apple's vision of what it should be. And so the reward of that risk of facing off against companies saying you're going to fail, you have no idea what you're doing is huge.
If I could just interject for a sec, if we could
go to the question.
Okay, thank you.
But I think the important note to go to there is that it does actually have an impact on a positive side of innovation. The ability to patent actually produces an upside effect because without it, a lot of people don't take those risks. TiVo spent 9 years fighting against EchoStar, who essentially said, screw you, we're big, we're not taking a license. And it harmed them. And yet TiVo was absolutely an innovative company that did innovative things that changed the way we watch television. So I think it's important that in this context of the harm to innovation that has been extensively discussed, we remember that the risk-reward profile that's created by some of these patents actually has some positive impact on innovation. Because it means, you know, I'm willing to roll the dice and spend a lot of money on R&D. I'd like the panelists to talk to address the question of the reward that patents provide on innovation front.
Could you also identify yourself?
Oh, yeah. Morgan Reed with the Association for Competitive Technology.
Thank you very much.
So I think that that picks up on the point that Ray and Sasha and we were all just discussing just now. And my guess would be that there's not one person on this patent that doesn't strongly believe in the patent system and the importance of innovation, and it, to the point that it goes without saying, but let's say it. We're a strong supporter, on Verizon's behalf, we're a strong supporter of intellectual property rights, and we both defend and, we're constantly, like every company, in patent litigation. This specific situation is one where we, again, just feel like, without reference to any particular case, that it really is this hot war, white hot war, with an unlimited arsenal, and we don't see it working itself out anytime soon without a renewed and continued emphasis on public interest.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Hi. So,
can you please identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm Tim Lee. I'm a journalist for Ars Technica.
Thank you.
Which is a publication that a lot of like computer programmers and technical type people read. And I'm struck by sort of the lack of a sense of urgency with this discussion. So a lot of my readers, programmers who are the people that the patent system is supposed to be rewarding and encouraging to innovate, basically feel like the patent system is a net negative from the perspective of their incentive to innovate. And that basically, at least in the software industry and maybe a few other related industries, that we would be better off if there were dramatically fewer patents, maybe no patents at all. And it seems like there's maybe a sort of a culture gap between the way sort of things are seen in Silicon Valley and the way things are seen among sort of the patent bar in Washington, D.C., where the kinds of reform proposals that like the ones you see in American Invents are seen as very timid and really not likely to make a big change. So I wonder if we can talk about, we just spent an hour talking about all the problems that it creates for innovation. Why isn't there more discussion of sort of more serious reforms that would work to make it much harder to get patents, reduce the number of patents out there, rather than just these kind of procedural changes like, you know, switching from first to file or first to invent, that sort of thing?
Mr. Chen, do you have a perspective on that?
Yeah, it's a great question because it comes up basically every 5 years, I think. The question is, should we be patenting software-related inventions, you know, those kinds of functionalities for computers? And, you know, this has been a debate that's been going on in this country for decades and decades. in decades, really. And, you know, the way we are, where we are now is, at least according to the state of the case law, is that, yes, you can patent it under certain conditions. And at this point in time, there have been some conversations, part of patent reform, where there were interest groups that wanted to insert that into the debate. And so, you know, there's a question about business method patents. Should those have been eradicated? And basically where Congress landed, you know, in carefully balancing as many different interests as possible, was something that eliminated basically tax strategy patents. There's a provision in there that essentially makes it all but impossible to get a patent on a so-called pure tax strategy. At the same time, they found other ways to try to improve the quality of patents overall, but didn't try to do anything on software alone by itself. At this point in time, it would be a little bit radical to eliminate patents related to software simply because we've been living in this world for so long. There's so many property interests that have developed and so many reliance interests at this point. So I think that it'd be a particular challenge now to basically clear the field of all those people that have been inventing with an eye towards being able to get a patent.
And part of the debate's also gone on in other countries as well. They have argued whether or not copyright protection is better for software. There have been a number of arguments. But to answer your readers directly, I said my guess would be that when you try to do something like get a reform bill of something as basic as patents through Congress, the interests and the parties and the compromise have to be made really don't allow for one area to receive the kind of emphasis that your readers probably would like. And I don't foresee that they would have the political influence in that to address one small slice of that, that the entire bill has been fought for at least 5 years since I've been playing in the area. It's had input from you know, very major companies who have a large scale to do with the economy. It's have input from people who are one-man shop or one-woman shop. So to say, why didn't it address this thing or that thing, you're asking for a political science course that we're not equipped up here to give you, really. And that's about the best I think we can do.
And just real quickly, as I understand it, the theory behind patenting in this area is, you know, we patent hardware that improves devices, computers. And so whether you're improving functionality of a general purpose computer by hardware or firmware or software, those are in some ways equivalent, and so therefore you would, as you patent one, you would make eligible the patenting of the other.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Corey Carpenter, George Mason Law School. The panel discussed various agency and legislative reforms that may, you know, change Microsoft's calculation when they want to license a particular technology. But what does the panel think about judicial reforms that would keep, like, a nuclear Apple from seeking a preliminary injunction at the district court level and not really need to actually go through the full process of having a judicial outcome if they've already delayed something that's as fast as the smartphone market?
I don't know. Are you familiar with any time they have gotten preliminary injunctions? Because they certainly don't do that at the ITC, and I'm not aware that in this market there's been a great deal of success in preliminary injunctions. But I don't know that this is a problem in this market, because if ever there were a bunch of companies that had monetary damages available at the end of the day, this is your bunch. So in light of eBay and the availability of monetary damages, I don't foresee that as a particular problem.
As far as I know, they've been trying and failing to get a lot of preliminary injunctions, which is in part one of the reasons everyone's been turning to you.
Well, they're not getting them from us either, so.
Well, yeah, the standard to win a preliminary injunction is particularly high, and it was made high by the Federal Circuit in a case a decade ago. There was a famous patent called the so-called one-click patent by Amazon.com. And they tried to get a preliminary injunction against BarnesandNoble.com on this one-click function of, you know, buying books over the internet. And they got the preliminary injunction from the district court, but then the Federal Circuit reversed it, and the Federal Circuit put some real teeth into in the making it difficult to really prove and establish that you merit getting a preliminary injunction in a patent infringement case.
Next question, please.
I'm Rob Pegoraro. I'm a freelance tech journalist who's been a bit of a critic of the patent system. I was interested to see in a lot of the discussion of the American Invents Act, it seems to imply that this is going to give us better patents. Therefore, we have a lot of patents that maybe wouldn't have passed muster under AIA. And yet, they're sort of sitting around. We sort of have this half-life of these patents that probably shouldn't have been issued, wouldn't have been issued today. How long will it take to clear those out?
Well, I think, you know, we issue a lot of patents every year, right? And a lot of the time, I don't know how often, it's hard to know. Because it's an ex parte process, we don't really have perfect information in evaluating the patentability of someone's application, someone's invention. So that's what these processes, these administrative review processes are designed to do, which is to encourage other people who might have access to information that we didn't have to bring it to our attention so that we can quickly reevaluate those claims. In terms of, we're not going to clear out every single bad patent. You know, that's not what it's designed to do. But what it is designed to do is to clear out the patents that are most important to other people. And that is what really the test is. That doesn't mean that every single time someone triggers an administrative review, we're going to banish the patent. You know, sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, under our current slower reexamination regimes. But there's at least this opportunity to test the quality of these patents in a much more fast, expeditious, and cheaper way than we currently have in district court. And not in terms of speed with respect to the ITC, because they move.
Yeah, let me throw something else here, because Ray's not allowed to say these things, but I am. And that is
stop,
that,
Judge, don't do it.
Well, as long as the PTO's budget is not funded in full, as long as money is siphoned off, they won't be able to do everything that they would like to and everything that they should. One of the big problems they've had out there is they have very good and willing people. I've been out there. I know a lot of them. And they've been underfunded. They do not have the personnel. They would like to hire more. They would like to have the budget do that. And, you know, you have to look at whether there's a problem with something that's systemic or whether it's personnel. And I think they've got very good personnel, but the budget has been a continual problem with PTO since, you know, I've been playing with this 5 years, and I have friends of mine who are much older than me, have been playing with it for 50 years, and they say it's pretty much the same. So, you know, I will defend them in ways they won't, because they're better ladies and gentlemen than that. But until they're fully funded, you really can't fully judge them. And they work very hard at it. They're making all the improvements they can. But if they don't have the right numbers and they don't have the right budget, then you're not going to get a fully satisfactory response to a question like yours. And it is certainly not the fault of anybody that's managing the PTO or their workers out there. But as you know, how many years has it been since Congress gave them the full budget they promised, what, 20 years ago? Mm-hmm. You know, it hasn't happened. And that has been an ongoing difficulty, and I think they're dealing with it as well as it can be done. I've out there, I've looked at it a lot, but that is a problem, and they're too polite to mention it, but I'm not.
So it sounds like the half-life is more than the year it would take in an optimal sense to get a patent rejected under this new review procedure.
Well, it depends. I mean, most patents nobody really care about, frankly. You know, we issue them, but they never get asserted. And so those, you know, whether they're good or bad, in the most practical, cold-blooded sense, doesn't really matter, because they never get litigated.
But I'm pretty sure that each one of the companies on this chart has recently hired at least several lawyers to force re-exams of as many of their opponents' patents as possible. So the worry I have is not around will these get brought to the PTO for re-examination, but are you guys going to be overwhelmed by the workload?
Yeah, we're deeply concerned by that, because we think that with these new proceedings, it will be attractive for people to come to the agency and challenge other people's patents. But and we don't really know how popular these proceedings will be. I'll say that they're designed to be priced at cost recovery, so they're not going to be cheap.
What was that we said about $40 billion?
And our last question for the day
Nathan Music, Congressional Budget Office. I've got a question about these, to me at least, remarkable data on patent arsenals and patent suits.
Could you identify yourself? I'm sorry.
Nathan Music, Congressional Budget Office.
Okay, thank you.
And regarding the data on patent arsenals and suits, there's a characterization of the number of patents, and there are two categories, essential to standard and other. And my first question is there some notion, could we get a better definition of what essential to standard is? And the second question is then making a correspondence between the arsenals to the patent suits. Am I safe in assuming that all of the patents that are subject to litigation are essential ones?
So that's, to take your second question, that's going to vary. And I should say that we did not go out and count every patent and don't know what they are. We just looked at the classifications and picked up the numbers that way. And I would love to personally take credit for having put this chart together. I was not the one who did. So let me, if you'd like, give me your card and I can get you some more information on that.
If I could just add, a lot of the patents that are essential to the wireless standards are locked into industry standard patent pools, which are required to be licensed at reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. So you'll find a lot of the litigation is not around patents that are essential because they may be in these, for instance, GSM patent pools, but around patents that companies think are their differentiators. Technologies.
I want to thank everyone for coming today, and please give a round of applause to our panelists. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the State of the Net.